Hello, America, and all of our listeners all over the world. You're listening to another exciting installment of Let's Weekend. I'm your host, and most Brandon Perkins. Joining me, as always, is Chris Elogi and Teresa Sammons. Say hi to the good people, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, so it is January 20th, 2024, when we are recording this. And, yeah, I'm sick of the cold now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I was fine when it was like around, you know, 50, 40-ish, maybe even high 30-ish, you know. I can handle that. But this, like, being in the teen shit, yeah, I'm over it now.
And for so long, too.
Oh, yeah. Now, understand, it's not unusual for us to get really cold weather down here sometimes. But that particular storm, so there, for those who don't know, there was this huge, like, wind, like, cold front with, like, a storm in it that swept through the southeast. Not this week, but, like, around last week. And it was, like, by the time it got to us, it was fairly, like, done. Like, oh, we had, like, some gusty winds and a bunch of rain, and that was about it. But other places, like, straight up lost power for a while. And, yeah, if you work at a grocery store like me, well, you know what that means.
Bread, milk, panic.
Bread, milk, peanut butter, you know, ramen noodles. A run on all that shit.
Yeah.
And let me tell you something. We run out of ramen noodles pretty much every damn day.
Serious.
Yeah, because people buy them by, like, the pack, you know? And
yeah, well,
and I don't mean, like, those individual wrapped, but no, I mean, like, the case.
The 20 packs.
Yeah, the 20 packs that cost, like, $5. And it's like, you know, it's like the Maruchan brand, which is, like, the old reliable, but let's be honest, kind of bargain basement brand of ramen noodles. But, yeah, so... And then, of course, there was on top of the fact that, oh, yeah, you step outside and it's suddenly below fucking freezing. which is, oh, so much fun. But anyway, so what are we going to be talking about this week? Well, among other things, there's still the ongoing conflict in Israel and Gaza. The Justice Department released their report on all the shit that went down at Uvalde, and it's about as awful as you can imagine. AI once again rears its ugly head because this time it happened at Sports Illustrated. We had the GOP caucuses that happened in Iowa because that's still have not understood why that apparently is so important since they pretty much all haven't meant shit for the last decade, but whatever. And we got a bunch of other stuff. And of course, we got a couple of trailers, including the new Adam Sandler drama. Yes, that's actually a thing that's happening. And it actually looks good. Actually doesn't look half bad. And we'll have all that more in this week's episode of Let's Weekend. So, start us off as always. Chris, tell us what you've been doing this week.
Yeah, I've been enjoying the cold. I had to work a bit. I think it was Wednesday. That was for most of the time below freezing or below zero wind chill. Which is a particular level of fun where even if I'm, you know, layered up pretty well, there's still a bit of, you know, like the head mask I have on where it's like, I can't really quite, you know, cover up the eye area and such. So having like that nice little fun kind of headache you get when you've got that much skin in that area kind of dealing with the extreme cold. That's really kind of fun. But yeah, that really fucked up my sense of temperature because the next day it was like 24 and I was like, oh, it's warm now. Didn't even like wear gloves or anything like that. Even when I was wearing the previous day, I was like, nah, it's too warm for this. But yeah, we got a bunch of snow, like maybe 4 or 5 inches. I don't know. Friday nights, most of Friday through Saturday morning. That was nice to see for once. So we've been lacking in snow for the past couple of years for the most part. So that's been fun to at least see. And we're going to warm up finally on Monday to the 30s. Mm. See what that's like again.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
we're actually getting
glorious.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's actually going to get up into the 70s this week.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. For like 3 days, and then it's going to drop back down.
I think we're going to get up into the 40s, and then it'll rain.
Yeah. Exactly.
That process that'll be like, oh, you just ruined it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, we might hit 50 on Thursday. Yeah.
Don't get crazy now, Mother Nature.
That's better than when it was 60 degrees on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And I wore pants out of spite for climate change. Everybody's like, oh, it's so nice. It's like, it's Ohio. It's not supposed to be 60 on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
No, it's not. And that actually caused the forsythia outside of our condo to start blooming in early January.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
And probably die real quickly.
Oh, so dead. Everything out there is dead.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the fun of being around the Great Lakes is not only is your weather even more random than usual, but then you get that kind of stuff where it's like, oh, it's actually nice, but not at the right time for Mother Nature, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the fun stuff. For things I've been doing, I haven't been watching too much. I did get back to Squid Game The Challenge, the reality show based on the Squid Game original show. And it ends up being very good by the end as they go through different games and kind of play up there's a lot of good editing with it in the reality show.
Mm-hmm.
As they do a good job of framing certain things, and when they get to like the, if you know the original show, the marbles moment of letting these people pair off with the people that they like the most, and then immediately being like, "All right, you're gonna have to eliminate one of you two," and being like, "Oh shit!" They get their good moments of like, "Oh, these are two people that I assume most people watching like." And letting you deal with the tension of, you know, what's the awful thing that's going to happen, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then you also see some outright racism there.
Oh, of course.
When, say, people of opposite races and genders get there and you're like, oh, this person's pulling this thing you always hear about, but it's, you know, recorded on, you know, a big streaming show for everybody to be like, see, this is what happens kind of thing. But yeah, fun show ends in some interesting ways. And yeah, the way they do like the glass bridge is pretty neat. I would like to see what they, cause they had the people drop and I'm like, they have to be dropping in like water or something. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But they drop and you just see them go into the darkness. Maybe that's CG or something. But yeah, they do some fun stuff there. So, and they announced like last month, I think, that they're doing a season 2. So that'll be interesting to see. But that's been pretty much what I've been watching. Other stuff I've been playing, more Spirit Hunters, Infinite Horde, the Vampire Survivors clone that's on consoles and PC. Kind of trying to wrap this up here at some point. Working my way through the last like 7-8 trophies. It's, I can see the end game here of sorts, where I have the hardest one I was doing is to get 100 upgrades in the hardcore mode, which is, you know, like Diablo, you keep playing until you die. And like, dying a bunch because I'm playing with the level of cushioning that having a bunch of upgrades in the regular mode has for you, but you start with none of that. So but I managed to get a string of few good runs in there and made that work out just fine. But yeah, that's been what I'm working on, beating all the stages on hard, and then I have to do it on brutal mode, which will be quite a challenge, but I think I can do it. And then, yeah, the other game I'm playing a decent bit this week is Army of Ruin, another Vampire Survivors clone. It's on consoles and PC. Just kind of run through some challenges there. Nothing really too complicated, but yeah, that's been pretty much it for me. So how about you, Teresa?
Yeah, Teresa, what about you?
Well, also been doing the freezing thing. Our wind chills were in the 30s and 20s below for, yeah, I think it was a solid week. It was a long time. It was way too long. Mm. And just the other day, the winds finally stopped howling. So there's a lot of not great with yeah. the weather here, too. But it is currently 4. The low tonight is only -6. I don't give a crap about the wind chill anymore. I don't care. we were out in it. I had MLK day off. And my kid and I were out. We ran like 3 little errands and we could not wait to get back home. It was so cold. So we've been watching a lot of stuff, keeping nice and warm. Mm-hmm. We went back to Dragon Ball Z because, mm-hmm. yeah, we kind of set that to the side for a while and wanted to pick it back up. And we're at the point where Goku is about to make it back from Snake Way. Mm. So we're really close. A bunch of people have already died, which, you know, I mean, I watched it off and on when it was on TV. So I kind of have a good idea of where it's going. We watched Puss in Boots: Last Wish, which was a lot of fun. And I like the way that it ended. It yeah. is kind of foreshadowing a little bit of what may be coming next out of the studio. So yeah, we'll keep an eye on it. Super cute. And Antonio Banderas is getting a little bit older, though. You can kind of hear it in his voice. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all do. Been watching a lot of YouTube, and one thing that I found that I was particularly amused by was John Mulaney's take on Pride and Prejudice. And mm-hmm. somebody had spliced in, like, movie clips. And it could have been in his special that they did that. I'm not sure. But it was, like, 50 different kinds of hilarious. I loved it. So if you've watched way too much Pride and Prejudice, you'll definitely like that. But for the most part, this week, I've been swearing at Microsoft Word at work because it's been a nightmare. Like, that stupid program.
Mm-hmm.
It screws up everything all the time. But other than that, minimal gaming. I've been trying to make my elbows feel better because I have a tennis elbow. And I'm about tired of not gaming, so I don't care. They're not really getting better with resting, so yeah, I'm going to start gaming again.
Mm-hmm.
That's really about it. What have you been doing, Brandon?
Well, as far as gaming is concerned, I finally decided to just sort of step up and play that game that basically just about every frickin' streamer from here to everywhere has been playing for like the past month and a half, which is I decided to go on Steam and get a copy of Fear and Hunger. Now, Fear and Hunger is, well, it's actually two games now. There's this and its sequel, which is Fear and Hunger Termina. Fear and Hunger is a game that was made in RPG Maker. Have you guys ever played any games that were made in RPG Maker before?
Yeah.
Okay, so first thing you need to know is you would not know this game was made in RPG Maker if the developer themselves did not tell you, because pretty much none of the assets you see in the game come with that program. It's entirely all made by the developer, and it's literally one developer. This was another one of those solo projects. He drew all the art assets, all the environments, all of the cutscenes and the animations and the sprites and all that stuff was done by them. So it's a one thing affair. And it's actually, in a lot of ways, it's not a very long game. You could probably finish the whole thing in about, theoretically, like maybe a few hours. But the thing about Fear and Hunger is that it basically lives and dies through RNG. And Also by the fact that it kind of tricks you into what you think this kind of game is going to be. Because Fear and Hunger is not an RPG. Don't get me wrong, it looks like an RPG. A lot of its gameplay is very RPG-like. Its combat is turn-based RPG-style mechanics. But Fear and Hunger is not an RPG. Fear and Hunger is a survival horror game with an RPG framework. And that game basically teaches you this right off the bat. When you go up to the gate of the dungeon that you're going to be spending most of the game in, and you're immediately attacked by a pack of vicious dogs who 9 times out of 10 will pretty much kill you right then and there. So it's sort of like, you know, the whole sort of Dark Souls, Elden Ring type of school of tutorials where it's teaching you, there are places you can go and there are enemies you can fight, but it's probably a good idea to understand that you don't necessarily have to fight everything you come across. In fact, sometimes just straight up avoiding it altogether is the best route possible. And that's basically what Fear and Hunger is. You figure out pretty quickly that if you go through this front entrance, you will be attacked by the dogs. And make no mistake, the dogs do not just stay in one area. They will track you all through the dungeon. So, yeah. But there is a side entrance that you can use, and that can help you avoid the dogs altogether, and that's your first lesson. But the thing about this game is that if there's one thing about Fear and Hunger you should understand, it's this. This game hates you. It hates you and it wants you to suffer. See, not only is the visuals of this game incredibly nightmarish, the things that happen in this game are also incredibly nightmarish. Horrible, horrible things happen to you, the people in your party, and the all other people that you encounter in this game. And when I say that, I don't mean like the standard issue Silent Hill, oh, they get dragged off and then get butchered or whatever. No, I mean, there is one monster in this thing called the Harvestmen, which are these weird, like, spindly spider-like guys. If they kill you, well, if they fight you in battle, there will be a whole cutscene that plays after where they will slowly turn your limbs into a pretzel with very loud cracks, and then they will strip off your pants, shove their hands up your anus, and start scooping out your organs.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're not joking.
I am not making this up. That is 100%. And honestly, that's probably not even like the most explicit thing that happens in this game. So one of the things you have to know about this game, I talked about the RPG mechanics. The combat in this game is unusual compared to pretty much every other like RPG under the sun, because most of the time when you encounter something, it's usually not like a party of animals. You know how like when you're like playing like Final Fantasy or Dragon Quest or whatever, and you come across like a monster on the field, and then suddenly it turns out like there's maybe like 2 or 3 of them attacking you in a group. That's actually pretty rare in this game. Most of the combat here is one-on-one encounters. But what's different is that all of the enemies in this game have, and this is actually true for your character as well, all of them have attacks and life bars and stuff that are specific to every one of their limbs. So like they have like arm, you know, like they've got health bars for their arms, for their legs, for their torsos, for their heads, all that stuff. And this is important because a lot of the combat in this game has a strong strategic edge to it. A lot of the enemies like are very powerful and can kill you in a very short amount of time. But if you think and like attack them, you know, attack their limbs and stuff, you can attack their legs. It'll knock them off balance and it'll make their heads easier to attack. Or you can take off their arms and it'll like take away their ability to use a particular attack. Like one of the main enemies in this game that you come across are the dungeon guards, who are like these weird mongoloid ogre looking dudes who basically carry around these enormous like cleavers. If you can, you know, destroy the arm that's carrying the cleaver, that basically takes away their major attack. If you can then take out their legs, it'll make them incredibly easier to finally, you know, kill for good. But don't really expect to get anything out of it, because there are no like experience or level up type stuff in this game. You do get like stronger equipment and you can like craft stuff, but the whole like, you know, the whole thing of like getting experience to level up is not a thing in this game. And in fact, a lot of times when you kill an enemy, you're not going to get anything out of it other than the fact that it takes them permanently out of the game, you know, and let, you know, until you die and have to do another run. As far as like save points in this game are concerned, there's pretty much like one free save you get in the game, and then after that there's a 50-50 chance, because it's the sort of typical RPG sort of mechanic of, yeah, you go and find a bed and sleep there and that lets you, you know, save your game or whatever. After that, every time you do it, there's a 50-50 chance that something will try to attack you in your sleep.
Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. And yeah, this is one of those games where it's like, it's not so much the shock value of it, although believe me, there is some pretty fucking shocking stuff that happens when you play this game. But also the fact that this is one of those games that has just a ton of lore and world building in it. And it requires you to like play it multiple times to get more and more out of it, which is part of the reason why this game has gained such a following, and also why it sort of started to appeal to the streamer mindset, I guess, even though this game's actually been around a while. This game actually came out like in 2019, so it's been around a few years. I think part of the reason it started getting on everybody's radar was because the sequel, Termina, only came out, like, I think, late last year. So, suddenly, you know, it was just on a bunch of people's radar. But yeah, that's Fear and Hunger. It's only like, it's not a whole lot on Steam, like maybe $10. It's not very expensive. You'll get a lot out of it if you understand what you're getting into. And please keep it away from the children, because they absolutely should not get anywhere near this, like at all. But other than that, I've also been playing the other game that a lot of people have been talking about suddenly. And this one only got became like available more or less yesterday. It's called Pal World. Now, have any of you heard of this game yet?
Yes.
Okay. Teresa, describe what Pal World is.
It is a game that my kid keeps telling me about and I halfway listen to, and it sounds really cool. And it's like Pokemon mashed up with something else.
It's kind of like Pokemon mashed up with Valheim, basically. It's a survival game where you wake up on this particular set of lands. It's an, I guess, an island or whatever, that is inhabited by pals. And these pals, it's not really even subtle. Most of them are very clear, like XBs of Pokemon. Like, yeah, all of them. It's not even subtle. And like I said, it is first and foremost a survival game. And if you've played any of those games, be it Valheim or Rust or anything like that, you know how these games start. You start off, you basically got nothing. You have to slowly collect stuff, build yourself a shelter, build yourself equipment. You know how this goes. The difference in this game, of course, is the pals. That's sort of the major difference here. And the pals sort of like overall sort of mechanic, it does operate very similarly to like Pokemon. You have all these pals running around, and you have to, when you encounter them, you have to use a pal sphere. That's literally what it's called. You have to weaken them first and then capture them. And then when you capture them, you can have them basically follow you around. You can have them, start working, you know, doing stuff at your base, you know, getting resources and stuff. You can have them guarding it. You can have them come out and fight battles with you. The video game cruelty potential is 100% in effect here. because you can do horrible, horrible things to these poor creatures. You can use them as human shields. You can use them as, you know, weapons that you toss at people. You can basically, you can like build a farm and have them work on that farm and have them stay working on that farm until they die. Like, you do have to feed them, obviously, but the game basically rewards you on both a bit. It's like this sort of balance between like pragmatism and kindness, because if you do treat the pals well, they will not only level up, but they'll become very loyal and they will continue to do stuff for you. If you mistreat them too much, they will eventually rebel and kill you. So yeah. But this game right now is like an early access. So like it's not really full yet. It's not a full game just as yet. Like, the foundation is there and a lot of the stuff is there, but like the overall, like, you know, lore and stuff like that isn't really there yet. But yeah, you ever played? I know for sure, Teresa, you've played Pokemon for years, so you know this. After a while, you started playing Pokemon, you started to realize, you know, it would be kind of terrifying to live in this universe if you really think about it.
And then they did the movie. They did Detective Pikachu, and I do not want to live in a Pokemon world. Yeah, that's absolutely freaking terrifying.
Yeah, but here's the thing that Pal World does. It takes that realization, and then it follows through on like the logical conclusion, which is that, yeah, if Pokemon existed, they wouldn't just be like used for like, oh, we're going to have fun little fighting tournaments and, you know, use them for like, you know, no, the military would utilize them for like weapons and they'd be used on for human experimentation and all this other shit. And
yeah, forced labor.
Yeah. And that's basically what Pal World more or less just decided to, just go full on. As you can imagine, a lot of Pokemon fans do not like it at all. Oh, they hate Pal World. There's been this whole thing about on Twitter of a bunch of Pokemon fans constantly spamming, you know, the Pokemon company's Twit feed, trying to tell them, hey guys, there's this game. I think they might be, you know, your copyrights and whatever. And you know,
yeah, they're trying that.
Yeah, but yeah, and as for like other stuff, yeah, Hasbun Hotel finally came out like on like for reals now on Amazon Prime, and it was pretty much what I hoped for. It more or less exceeded my expectations. I'm not really going to spoil it or anything because, you know, it's only been out for like a week now and I still want people to take their times to, you know, discover this series naturally. I will say though, it would be a good idea to go on Vibzy Pop's channel and watch the pilot, because the show does canonically take place about a week after the pilot ends. So it may be a bit of a trip considering, you know, that it's got like major studio backing instead of, you know, the indie sort of creation that the pilot was. And also because, you know, the voice cast is completely different.
It is.
Yeah. Okay. They recast all the voices. And if you look who they casted and watch the show, you'll understand why mostly.
Okay.
Because everybody, Hasbun Hotel is first and foremost a musical. And if you watch the pilot, you'll realize that pretty much all the characters that had singing parts, they had two voice actors, you know, the regular voice actor and the singing voice actor. Hasbun Hotel does not have that. All the voice actors do all the singing themselves. So, and, you know, a lot of them are like, you know, Broadway veterans, you know. Alex Brightman, the guy who played Beetlejuice, is there. James Englehart, he was the genie for the Aladdin musical. Jeremy Jordan is in there a lot, you know, the voice actress for Mirabelle in Encanto, she's in this too. I will just say that, and I will also say be prepared, because the first couple of episodes are fairly, you know, lighthearted, even though it's like fairly dark humor. But right around the third episode, it starts getting serious. And the fourth episode gets incredibly dark, with some talking about, like, you know, themes of like sexual abuse and drug addiction. And like it's not subtle, and it's not going to do subtext here. They make it very plain what's happening here and what it does to people. There, the character who is a victim here, he legit has a breakdown that happens that is actually pretty scary to watch because of just how real it looks.
Oh, wow.
Oh yeah. But yeah. Watch it. And just for anybody who's curious, it's an 8-episode season. They put up the first 4 this week. You'll get the next 2 episodes next week, and then the final 2 episodes for this season the week after. So, yeah. And last but not least, it's freezing, and I won off. Like, I just, you know, I'm sick of the Winter Wonderland ride. I won.
Well, Monday, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that when everybody's going to warm up?
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, I want off Mr. Frosty's wild ride. But yes. So, alrighty then. So I do believe we have that segment's all well and done. Does anybody have anything else that they want to add before we move on?
No.
Nope.
Okay. Alrighty then. Well then, with that out of the way, it is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show. Brandon's random factoid, and Teresa, unlike me, you know, I was born in 1987, and so you actually lived through had more experience of the 80s than I did.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, you were still relatively young, right?
I was born in 75, so I wasn't, like, terribly young.
Okay. All right, so when you grew up, you know, in that era, you remember that one of the things that was constantly on people's minds and sort of, and especially in pop culture, was the threat of nuclear war.
Yes.
Like, it was a major part of, I mean, they made a freaking television movie entirely around what would happen if, you know, the Soviets attacked the U.S. with nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
The Day After Tomorrow. Brits, for their part, actually did a far better and far more traumatizing film called Threads, but that's neither here than there. What if I told you that we actually came extremely close to that happening?
We probably did.
Yeah. So, do you remember that song, 99 Red Balloons?
Yeah. Yeah, and it was not as upbeat as we thought it was.
Yeah, so that song is basically about how, well, it depends on what version you're listening to, because, you know, the original German version and the lyrics for the English version are actually different. They both sort of have, like, the same way it starts, where it's like, yeah, me and a friend, we went and with our money, went to a toy shop, we bought a bunch of red balloons, blew them up, and then let them fly in the air, and basically it starts a whole sort of sequence of events that ends up in nuclear Armageddon, more or less. What if I told you that an incident kind of like that actually happened, and we were a hair's close to the Russians actually launching nukes at us, and that the only reason it didn't happen is because one guy was smart enough to realize it was probably a false alarm?
And that is absolutely terrifying, isn't it?
Okay, yeah. Okay, so what we're talking about is called the 1983 Soviet Nuclear False Alarm Incident. And it basically goes like this. In the September 26th of 1983, you know, U.S., Soviet Union, Cold War is happening. We're both staring at each other, you know, staring daggers at each other across the waters and slowly building up our nuclear arsenals, just in case. Remember, this is 1983. This is happening during the Reagan administration. There was the Soviets had put out 14 let me see what they're called, SS-20, RSD-10 theater nuclear missiles. So NATO decided they were going to start doing putting their own missiles, their Pershing 2 missiles in Western Europe that would hit targets in Ukraine, Belarusia, Lithuania within about 10 minutes. And they had like others to point at Moscow. And then, of course, this was also happening at the time when, you know, psychological operations by the U.S. were working at the same time, where they were trying to test, you know, Soviet radar vulnerability and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Where they started doing clandestine naval operations with folks in the Barents, in Norway, the Black and Baltic Seas, all these different places. I'm getting a lot of this information from Wikipedia, just in case anybody's curious. According to accounts from both the CIA and the KGB, by 1981, obsessed with historical parallels with the 1941 German invasion and the rhetoric that was coming from the Reagan administration, and with no defense capability against the Pershing 2s, Soviet leaders were starting to believe that the United States was preparing a secret nuclear attack on the USSR, and initiated Operation Ryan. Under this, agents abroad monitored service and technical personnel who would implement a nuclear attack so as to be able to either preempt it or have mutually assured destruction. This then got worse in September of 1983, the 1st of September 1983, when the Soviet military shot down a South Korean passenger jet, Korean Airlines Flight 007, that had strayed in Soviet airspace. All 269 people aboard the aircraft were killed, including Larry McDonald, a U.S. representative, and many other Americans. The first Pershing 2 missiles were delivered to West Germany on the 1st of December that year. Bruce G. Blair, an expert on Cold War nuclear strategies and former president of the World Security Institute in Washington, D.C., says the American-Soviet relationship at the time had deteriorated to the point where the Soviet Union as a system, not just the Kremlin, not just Soviet leader Yuri Andropov, not just the KGB, but as a system entirely, was geared to expect an attack and to retaliate very quickly to it. It was an air trigger alert. It was very nervous and prone to mistakes and accidents. The false alarm that happened on Pantra's watch, we'll be talking about that, gentlemen, could not have come at a more dangerous, intense phase in U.S.-Soviet relations. All right, so that's the environment we're talking about. Cold War tensions are about as hot, are only, you know, at this point, the tensions were only higher during like the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is how everybody was feeling. And then the story goes like this. Petrov, the gentleman we're talking about, his name was Stanislav Petrov. On September 1983, Stanislav Petrov, a lieutenant colonel in the Soviet Air Defense Forces, was the officer on duty at the Sepurkov 15 bunker near Moscow, which housed the command center of the Soviet early warning satellites, codenamed OKO. Petrov's responsibilities included observing the satellite's early warning system and notifying his superiors of any impending nuclear missile attacks against the Soviet Union. If notification was received from the early warning systems that inbound missiles had been detected, the Soviet Union strategy was an immediate and compulsory nuclear counterattack against the United States, specified in the doctrine of mutual assured destruction. All right, so you got that? All right, here we go. Shortly after midnight, the bunker's computers reported that one intercontinental ballistic missile was heading towards the Soviet Union from the United States. Petrov considered the detection a computer error, since a first-strike nuclear war by the United States was likely to involve hundreds of simultaneous missile launches in order to disable any Soviet means of counterattack. Furthermore, the satellite system's reliability had been questioned in the past, so Petrov dismissed the warning as a false alarm, though accounts of the event differ as to whether he notified his superiors or not, after he concluded that the computer directions were false and that no missile had been launched. Petrov's suspicion that the warning system was malfunctioning was confirmed when no missile, in fact, arrived. Later, the computers identified four additional missiles in the air, all directed towards the Soviet Union. Petrov suspected that the computer system was malfunctioning once again, despite having no direct means to confirm this. The Soviet Union's land radar was incapable of detecting missiles beyond the horizon. So he literally had two different incidents. This happened twice. in the span of 24 hours where he could have made the wrong decision. It was secretly determined that the false alarms were caused by a rare alignment of sunlight on high-altitude clouds and the satellite's Molniya orbits, an error later corrected by cross-referencing a geostationary satellite. In explaining the factors leading to his decision, Petrov later cited his belief in training that any U.S. first strike would be massive, so five missiles seemed an illogical start. In addition, the launch detection system was new, and in his view, not yet wholly trustworthy, while ground radar had failed to pick up corroborative evidence even after several minutes of the false alarm.
Okay.
This is the aftermath. Afterwards, Petrov underwent intense questioning by his superiors about his actions. Initially, he was praised for his decision. General Yuri Volstantsev, then commander of the Soviet Air Defense's missile defense units, who was the first to hear his reports of the incident and the first to reveal it to the public in 1998, stated that Petrov's correct actions were duly noted. Petrov himself stated he was initially praised by his superiors and was promised a reward, but recalled that he was also reprimanded for improper filing of paperwork with the pretext that he had not described the incident in the military diary. He received no reward. According to him, this was because the incident and other bugs found in the missile detection system embarrassed his superiors and the influential scientists who were responsible for it, so that if he had been officially rewarded, they would have had to be punished. He was reassigned to a less sensitive post, took early retirement, although he emphasized this was not because he was forced out, as is sometimes claimed by Western sources, and suffered a nervous breakdown. Yeah. Oleg Kologin, the former KGB chief of foreign counterintelligence, who knew Soviet leader Yuri Andropov well, said that Andropov's distrust of American leaders was profound. It was conceivable that if Petrov had declared the satellite warnings valid, such an erroneous report could have provoked the Soviet leadership into becoming bellicose. Kologin said, "The danger was in the Soviet leadership thinking the Americans may attack, so we better attack first." Yeah, that is literally how close we came to this happening.
It was too close.
And I want to make clear what would have happened if he, and remember, he had two opportunities to make the wrong decision here within the space of 24 hours. Because let's be honest, think of him in his shoes and think about it. You saw that first one, you would have think, yeah, that's probably just one. But you suddenly saw four more coming out of it.
Yeah.
Would you have made the same decision he did? Really think about it.
It is hard to say.
Yeah. By the way, if you are curious about what would have happened if Petrov had not been in his station and somebody else less, you know, indefatigable as he was, there's actually an alternate history project you could go called 1983 Doomsday. There's like a whole wiki for it. It's basically an alternate timeline of what would have happened. It's not pretty, as you can imagine. The Soviets basically launched their entire arsenal at the United States as well as China. China in turn launches all of theirs. The U.S. launches their stuff at the Soviets as a countermeasure, and it's basically just chaos from there. So that was 1993. We were a hair's close to doomsday, and that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. Sleep well tonight, folks. All right. Well, with that out of the way, it is now time to go on to the show proper. And as always with the show proper, we start off with our assholes of the week. And our first asshole of the week is Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, says he will not allow a two-state solution in the wake of his war on Palestine.
Yeah, this is not a great thing. He's been specifically telling the U.S. as well that he does not want a two-state solution, which basically says exactly what you already expected out of him.
Yep.
And I believe he's also used the term from the river to the sea that people got upset about when people were using it in the context of, you know, Palestine having freedom. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that the people aren't doing that for Netanyahu doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Says everything you need to know. But yeah,
yep.
They are basically at this point kind of almost just doing controlled explosions and destroying as many big buildings as they can at this point. I think they've destroyed all the universities that Gaza had. So
yep.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, fun times over there.
Fun, fun, fun.
And that's not to say like Israel supports Netanyahu and his bloodthirst.
Mm-hmm.
They've had protests over there from Israelis that want the war to end.
Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty good bet that if and when this war ends and Netanyahu decides he wants to run for prime minister again, he almost certainly, if it's a fair election, will be voted out by a landslide. Because basically everybody in Israel blames him for letting this happen in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, not unless, you know, he decides to turn it into a dictatorship, which, you know, Israel has had that in the past. So, yeah, that happened. Also, the Justice Department released a scathing report on the cascading series of failures of the Uvalde Police Department during the school shooting. And yeah, it's about as bad as you can think it is. Because, yeah. It wasn't just the rank cowardice that was the worst part of it. Oh, it was a bad part of it. But it turns out these guys actively did try to cover it up.
Yeah, it's a whole thing here. Yeah, it documents the cascading failures of leadership, decision-making, tactics, policy, and training that all contributed to the failed law enforcement response that saw police officers wait more than 70 minutes in a school hallways before confronting and killing the gunman.
Mm-hmm.
And you can read it all here, too, as well. It's 610 pages, so I wouldn't blame anybody for not wanting to.
Mm-hmm. We seriously would not blame you. It is heavy shit.
Yeah, as it says here, the most significant failure was that responding officers should have immediately recognized the incident as an active shooter situation, using the resources and equipment that were sufficient to push forward immediately, continuously towards the threat until entry was made into classrooms 111 and 112, and the threat was eliminated. Yeah, the goal of the review is to provide an independent account of the law enforcement response to the shooting, to identify lessons learned to help prepare for future such incidents, and to provide a roadmap for community safety and engagement before, during, and after such events. And yeah, found the police arrived at the school and entered the building 3 minutes after the gunman, who was still actively shooting inside classrooms 111 and 112 at the time. They quickly identified the location of the gunfire, ran towards those rooms, consistent, the report says, with the practice of quickly engaging an active shooter. The police approached the rooms where the shooter was, but retreated after some of the officers were hit with shrapnel from the shooter's gunfire. From that point on, the report says, the police, including Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District Police Department Chief Pete Arredondo, began treating the incident as a barricaded subject scenario and not as an active shooter situation. And that was a critical mistake that contributed to the tragedy.
Yeah. No kidding.
So yeah, there's more here if you want to see it or read it. But yeah, not good.
Yeah. The staff of Sports Illustrated was laid off after their publisher missed a publishing rights payment. Because, Sports Illustrated is like, yeah, we're going to try and have AI write our articles. And, yeah, guess how that worked out.
Well, this is a little bit different. So the thing with the Sports Illustrated brand is that it is owned by Authentic Brands Group.
Yeah.
Since 2019, owned the magazine and the website. So the publishing rights to Arena Group. But the company missed a recent payment for those publishing rights, and ABG revoked them. Let's see. Yeah, the union says it's another difficult day. And what has been a difficult 4 years for Sports Illustrated under Arena Group, previously called the Maven Stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
We are calling on ABG to ensure the continued publication of SI and allow it to serve our audience in the way that it has for nearly 70 years. Yeah, they did affirm that Sports Illustrated will continue, but did not provide details on how. ABG said it terminated Arena's license because it did not pay the quarterly fee, despite being given a notice of breach and an opportunity to cure the breach. Essentially, notice that they were late and that they could still pay to avoid any issues, but they still missed the second chances there. So, yeah, that's not great. Especially getting a bunch of people to lose their jobs in ways that adds to all the awful stuff going on with publications these days. Mm. Especially when, you know, the sports industry is making more money than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Especially off the backs of the legalization of betting.
Mm-hmm.
As anybody watching TV or listening to podcasts or anything, hear ads for betting all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, this is the whole situation out of the way that they have run things with this company.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, the Arena Group are also the are being run by the 5-Hour Energy founder,
mm-hmm.
who owns a majority stake in there. He's an interim chief executive for the company now.
Mm-hmm.
Which is wild.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there were some details that there were other plans for the Sports Illustrated brand, like resorts and even brain pills. So basically a bunch of hokey shit. But you know what you want out of Sports Illustrated is brain pills.
Yeah. I swear. All right. But yeah, so those were the assholes of the week, but we do have hero of the week, and that hero is none other than Christina Applegate. She got a standing ovation at the Emmys when presenting an award after revealing her MS diagnosis in 2021.
Yeah. Pretty brave thing for her to do. She got up there with a cane and all that, did a little speech, even had a good joke here. Thank you so much. As they started, you know, standing up and applauding, he's like, oh my God, you're totally shaming me with disability by standing up. It's fine. Body not by Ozempic. Okay, let's go.
Yeah.
And yeah, also saying as she was getting constant applause, we don't have to applaud every time I do something.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she's obviously not doing great with MS. That is a disease that affects your body's central nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it sort of hard to get around at a certain point, and she uses a wheelchair a lot to get around. So
yeah, and the footage, she's using a cane to walk, and she still has to have assistance to do it as well. So
yeah, and she's talked at, let's see, ahead of last year's Walk of Fame, talking about how she's gained, you know, a bunch of weight because she's not able to move around much, and medication also adding to that. You know, not feeling like herself. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of the bad part of the disease, is it kind of traps you in your body. But yeah, there you go. Good to see her able to get some love.
Yeah. But anyway, with that, it's now time to move on to the proper show proper. And the first story we've got tonight is that Congress finally passed a new stopgap spending bill to push the deadline to March. So, yeah, once again, we're kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. And still kind of doing the two-tier thing.
Yeah.
Where it was, I think, January 19th and I think early February.
Mm-hmm.
And now the two deadlines are March 1st and March 8th.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll be making the same dance at the end of next month. Luckily, it's a leap year, so we get an extra day there for that. But yeah, still kind of dealing with this as the House is dealing with all of their shit, as Mike Johnson's not getting too much control over the far right branch of the House GOP.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes about a month from now.
Yeah. So yeah, we'll be doing all this shit again. And we'll see how that goes. That's going to be oh so much fun. The other big story, though, of course, was the Iowa caucuses happened this week. Well, the Iowa GOP caucuses at least did. I still do not understand exactly what the relevance of the Iowa caucus is supposed to be. Other than the fact that they're typically the first ones to happen, and that people constantly say it's supposed to be like a bellwether for like what way a race is going to go. But has it really?
Yeah, it's weird. I still don't really even understand how it works so much, but I believe the last three times we had new GOP people running for presidency, as far as no incumbent, all three lost after winning the Iowa, like Ted Cruz. I forget who the other ones were, but yeah, there were people that didn't matter, essentially, especially because Trump came on a few primaries after that, started winning and taking over for everything else in 2016. But yeah, this time around, Trump's the incumbent as far as everything we've seen. And yeah, like, this is a small subsection. It's like 100,000 people voted of the million or so GOP that are registered there.
Yeah.
So it's a small subsection of these people, especially when there was some nasty winter weather there.
Oh, yeah.
So that also depressed things a bit.
Oh, yeah. And if you're wondering who won, you know who won.
Yeah.
We all knew who won. It wasn't even close.
No.
Trump
got 51%, DeSantis 21%, Nikki Haley 19%, Vivek 7%, and then everybody else like 1%.
Yeah.
It's like nothing.
Yeah. Vivek, of course, immediately dropped out. Asa Hutchinson did the same.
Now they're jockeying for who's going to be VP.
Yeah. DeSantis and Haley are still, you know, still doing this uphill battle.
Yeah.
They're not going to win, let's be honest.
Well, I kind of wonder if they're sticking in there because they think that eventually there will be so many states that won't let him on the ballot that somebody's going to have to run.
Eh, possible. It's a possibility. Or, you know, he keels over dead.
That's
also a possibility.
Yeah, it's a possibility, but we can't get that lucky.
No, unfortunately. But, yeah, so that happened. And then, you know, that was, yeah, that was more or less the serious stuff for this week. But then we go on to the less serious stuff. Guinness is investigating. Oh, before I move on, you guys have heard of the Babylon Bee, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the sort of conservative alternative to the Onion. Yeah, you saw the one that they put up for Vivek after he dropped out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's about how, you know, Trump could staff him to run the White House 7-Eleven.
Yeah, instead of being his VP.
Yeah.
Man, that's freaking rude.
Yeah, and also, like,
that's our idea of humor is racism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that, it's also, like, old hat, too. Like, people have been telling that shit since the 80s.
Yeah.
But then again, that's
just in a Simpsons reference.
Yeah, for God's sake.
Yeah.
But Simpsons then again, that is the, their demographic, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's Elon Musk.
Yeah, basically.
And they're ilk.
Yeah. So now on to the less serious stories. Guinness, you know, the people behind the Guinness World Records, is taking time out of, you know, giving records to help prop up authoritarian regimes to investigate whether Bobby was actually the oldest dog that ever lived.
Yeah. Bobby, the purebred Rafero do Alentejo dog. I don't even really understand that breed. It looks like a darker, like, golden retriever kind of breed. But yeah, it was said to have, you know, lived over 31 years, but now they are investigating whether that's true at all. Yeah, as of Tuesday, the group said it is reviewing evidence on file while also looking for new information and reaching out to experts and those linked to the original application. As yeah, the breed typically doesn't live this long, but this dog did, supposedly, about twice as long as his breed typically does.
Yeah.
Yeah, and documents that they obtained, they claim the dog was born May 11th, 1992. February, the group declared Bobby the world's oldest living dog and oldest dog ever, ranking dethroned Spike, a 23-year-old Chihuahua mix from Ohio. who had just 2 weeks earlier earned the title of oldest sleeping dog. So yeah, trying to see if there's some foul play afoot, whether this is details that, you know, that exist to confirm this. But yeah, the AP reports that Guinness World Records officials received correspondence from some vets questioning the dog's age and took note of public commentary from vets and other professionals. So maybe from people that know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, we'll see.
Well, and it won't matter because there's some new vaccine that's coming out that is allegedly going to extend dogs' lives routinely into the 20-year range.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know a whole lot about it yet. I know the equivalent for cats to help with, is it hyperthyroid or, I don't know. Anyway, that one is still in clinical trials too. So
yeah.
Interesting like, stuff in veterinary science.
Is that a good 20 years or is that an expensive 20 years?
I think it's going to be a pretty good 20 years. I've had some cats get pretty close to 20, I guess. And yeah, those do get expensive. But allegedly this the cat vaccine at least is supposed to eliminate a lot of old age disease. So I don't know, maybe they're finding like the fountain of youth for cats. I'm conflicted on how I feel about that though. Cause they reproduce so fast.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough. I don't know enough to say if it's gonna be good or bad, but or if it's even gonna happen.
Yeah, not great for strays and like neighborhood cats that
roam
around a lot.
Yep.
Yeah. But yeah, moving on from there, we got some science news. The James Webb Telescope detected the earliest known black hole that's bigger than expected.
Yeah.
Okay.
They spotted this, the galaxy GNZ11 in 2016 by the Hubble Space Telescope. It was the most distant galaxy scientists had ever identified.
Hmm.
It was ancient form 13.4 billion years ago, a mere 400 million years after the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
But while that record has since been broken, the galaxy remains something of a puzzle. It was an oddly luminous galaxy for such an old and compact galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
They say here, to be that bright, it would have required a large number of stars packed in such a small volume.
Mm-hmm.
But given how young the universe was, it would have been hard to make all those young bright stars in that relatively short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But now a new paper entitled A Small and Vigorous Black Hole in the Early Universe, published in Nature. Some scientists and their colleagues have an alternate explanation for all that light. A supermassive black hole about 1.6 million times the mass of our sun.
Yeah.
The black hole itself doesn't emit any light, but all the material screaming toward it may well be hot and bright enough to produce the galaxy's intense radiance. And he says this is the earliest black hole ever detected. And its very existence calls into question whether or where certain black holes come from and how they feed and grow. And yeah, this is kind of an interesting black hole here. Is I'm trying to see here. The black hole is 1.6 million times the mass of our sun. It was in place just 400 million years after the dawn of the universe. So it kind of makes it kind of interesting to figure out, like, how did this thing form and get to its massive size that it is right now. So they run through a few scenarios. Rather than starting out small, perhaps supermassive black holes in the early universe were simply born big due to the collapse of vast clouds of primordial gas. Scenario two is that maybe early stars collapsed to form a sea of smaller black holes, which could have then merged or swallowed away matter way faster than we thought, causing the resulting black hole to grow quickly. Or perhaps somewhere in the middle. Yeah, I thought I saw a number here that was pulling in a lot of stuff, but maybe not, may not be detectable at the moment. But yeah, interesting stuff. Trying to figure out more about how the universe was formed and how these black holes work, since they're still pretty new things to decipher. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And yeah, let's see. Moving on from there. Alec Baldwin has been indicted again for involuntary manslaughter in the Rush shooting. Yeah, so that's happening again.
Yeah. this interesting to see this continue on. I figure this would I've seen people suggest this probably still won't go anywhere as a criminal matter versus a civil matter, and maybe get some money out of Alec Baldwin for what happened here with the shooting of Rush or Rust. Yeah, he was initially charged in this case in January 2023, but the charges were dropped 3 months later after Baldwin's defense team raised questions about whether his Colt 45 was functioning properly when it fired. Yeah, as they're filming a scene with Helena Hutchins in October 2021 when the gun went off, Baldwin maintained that he did not pull the trigger. But yeah, the experts reconstructed the gun, which had been broken during FBI testing, concluded that could have only been fired by a pull of the trigger. So yeah, maybe there'll be more conclusive evidence this time. We'll see, but yeah. So yeah, there you go.
All right. And yeah. This is why you have a union crew. See, this, because that's the thing. They wanted to try and get around all the union stuff, and then this shit happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. They effed around and they found out.
Yeah.
In a horrible way.
Yeah. And anyway, now for some business shit. Amazon will acquire a stake in Diamond Sports with their bankruptcy reorganization. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the whole thing that's been going on. So, you know, you absolutely know one part of this whole thing here. Diamond Sports Group is one of the largest operators of regional sports networks in the country.
Yep.
You may know them by the channels they run called Bally Sports.
Mm-hmm.
That they, you know, have different ones for each region. So they have ones here for Detroit, Florida, the Great Lakes, Indiana, Kansas City. There's a Midwest one, New Orleans, North, Ohio, Oklahoma, San Diego, SoCal, the South, Southeast, mm-hmm. Southwest, Sun, West, and Wisconsin. And yeah, they got some stakes in some other things of joint venture in Marquee, home of the Chicago Cubs, minority interest in Yes Networks, which is the Yankees and Nets, Brooklyn Nets network. But their parent company is Sinclair Broadcasting.
Yeah.
So they're tied into this whole thing that you may not have realized.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, they've been, the Diamond Sports Group has been going in bankruptcy for the past couple of years, and various groups have been, teams and such have been suing them for the mm-hmm. money they owe contractually.
Yeah,
for broadcasting these games, the rights to that mm-hmm. stuff. And MLB has been able to wrestle some of the MLB teams' rights to air that stuff on MLB TV, but it seems like Amazon's getting some money into here, making a minority investment in Diamond Sports Group
yep.
to be a part of this,
mm-hmm.
which under the terms of Amazon's investment, the tech mm-hmm. giant will enter into a commercial arrangement to provide access to Diamond services via Prime Video.
Mm-hmm.
Prime Video will become Diamond's primary partner, through which customers will be able to purchase direct-to-consumer access to stream local Diamond channels. Customers will be able to access all local DTC content,
mm-hmm.
Direct-to-consumer, including live MLB, NBA, and NHL games, pre- and post-game programming for the teams for which Diamond retains DTC rights
mm-hmm.
through Prime Video channels. Which I'm not sure which teams specifically will be affected by this. A number of them are trying to wrestle their rights back, but
mm-hmm.
they've been caught up in all of this bankruptcy shit here
mm-hmm.
Involving Sinclair Broadcasting.
Yeah.
Whose owner also just recently bought the Baltimore Sun.
People. Yeah, and was a total dick to all the people who were still working there, and yeah, that's just the beginning.
Yeah, like saying he wants them to work more on uncovering corruption, which is like a thing that they're already very good at.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't mean actual corruption, he means lefty corruption.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing that's like if they find it, they'll report on it, but it's not like a thing you should focus on.
Yeah.
Right.
Solely, but yeah, so there you go. More shit going on with Sinclair Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. They suck so bad.
Yeah. And now we're getting into the movie shit. And the first is, there will be a film adaptation of Until Dawn, which that, like, everyone could see that one coming.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it pretty much is.
Yeah. That could work, but I assume that they're going to take the idea and kind of do it on a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Because, one, you're not going to get, you know, Rami Malek and some of these others for this.
Mm-hmm.
Unless something weird happens, maybe.
Yeah.
But I assume it's not going to be a direct one-to-one adaptation of this because, you know, you could play that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very good for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Be a pretty good time to just do something new with it. But, yeah, they got the, let's see, screenwriter from It Chapter 2 and The Nun working on this.
Mm-hmm.
David F. Sandberg, who's done Annabelle Creations, Shazam, and Lights Out, will be directing this. So they got some notable talent for that. So we'll see how that goes.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. Not much else going on here, but they're working with PlayStation Productions on that. So maybe it'll turn out good.
Yep. We got an official trailer for Netflix's new flick, Spaceman, starring Adam Sandler.
Yeah, looks pretty neat, though.
Yeah.
I saw the teaser trailer a couple weeks ago, and it's mentioning some alien creature, and I was like, oh, I wonder what that is, and it's a fucking giant spider.
Yep. It's spider.
Like, I'm like, no.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck this shit.
Nope.
Why? Why?
Yeah, and it like space crawls around. Like,
yep.
Zero gravity crawls around, and it's like, that's fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Nah. But yeah, this comes from the director of Chernobyl, so it'll probably be pretty good.
Yep.
It involves a weird story where Adam Sandler's been out on this mission into the edge of the solar system, and has marital troubles, he assumes. And this alien spider thing happens to be talking to him, like helping him deal with that. Somehow, I don't know. But yeah, that could be pretty good. And based on the novel Spaceman of Bohemia.
Yep.
In case you're wanting to see what the source material is, but
already looking it up.
Yeah, the movie will be out March 1st on Netflix, so about a month and a half from now. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Still kind of weird that he's playing an astronaut in space with a big giant beard.
Yeah.
Where I would think they would require him to, you know, shave it every so often. Because I don't think astronauts usually grow much facial hair. Not this much.
Well, he's basically by himself up there, so.
Yeah, but still, I think there would be like a dress code of sorts.
Maybe. And we got a teaser trailer for Netflix's The Gentlemen.
Yeah, this is a new Guy Ritchie thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is basically a series based off of the original The Gentleman movie that he made. It's a follow-up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe an adaptation of that for the screen. But they've got a bunch of notable talent in this that looks pretty good. So yeah, that'll be, let's see, when is that out? March. No specific date on that. I'm sure they'll reveal it pretty soon.
Yeah.
So yeah.
There we go. That's it. We have got ourselves a show, folks. We have got ourselves a show. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, you got a question, comment, something you want us to read on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got a link for it in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at TuneIn, Google Play, RSS, archive.org, or really any kind of podcast aggregator you can think of. And if we're not there, just wait a few minutes. We will be. But yeah, so We're going to go ahead, wind it all down here. If you liked what you heard, please do not hesitate to share us with your friends, your families, your casual acquaintances, your mortal enemies, and everyone in between. And yeah, so we're going to go ahead, stop it here. We're going to go and bundle ourselves up because I am so sick of this cold shit. And hopefully when we talk to you next week, it'll be somewhat warmer. Maybe by a few degrees, I hope. You know? Because I would hope that it's not absolutely frigid up until the first day of spring, and then suddenly it's just hot and all the pollen everywhere. I am already dreading it. But anyway, we will see you all next week. Bye!